Okay, so here we are. First lecture, second term, and we're in social theory of law, and what we're going to do here, I don't know how many of you, have any of you actually looked at, since I did this last year as well, I've actually done this for quite a while, but for a few years I was off of this, but last year I came back and did it again. So did any of you get a chance to look at the website that I put up for last year's version of this module? No. Okay. Well, it does resemble what you'll get this time, so, but that's okay. You'll get it again anyway. Okay, so let's be clear about a few things. First of all, this module, right, so we've got, for people who are in the Joint Law Sociology Honors degree, this is the Bridgehead module. How many of you fall into that category? Okay. Okay, how many of you are taking this as an elective from sociology? Okay, and how many of you are taking it from law? Okay, so we've got kind of a nice split here. This term, this phrase social theory of law, in case Ralph didn't tell you, is a completely fabricated phrase. It doesn't really mean anything in particular. Okay, but what it does try to kind of bring together is basically sort of bringing out the sort of sociological dimension of the law, you might say. And I'm going to explain what I think that means, because sociology as a discipline came to a large extent out of the law. Okay, so there's a kind of, actually sort of a genealogical relationship between the two fields. And I'm going to talk about that in the substance of the lecture, but I want to get a few of the sort of practical details out of the way. And the first thing is, well, let's start with the fact that there's a reading week on the sixth week, which means there will be no lecture that week. I will be putting the course outline and the materials. If you have a look at what I did last year, you can easily get to the website from my own webpage. You'll get a sense of what the webpage will look like for this version of the module. What you will see for each week will be a reading. There will be the audio of the lecture once it's there, and there will be these notes that will basically be things I'm typing up while I'm talking. And you'll get that for each week. Now, for week six, it's a reading week. That's the week of February 15th. So there is no lecture, no seminar. There is no seminar this week either, okay? In terms of assignments, of course, you have the exam. But you also have this 2,500-word paper. This is going to be on one of two topics. You will get those two topics certainly by the end of this week. Now, the question I have for you, because this module is administered by law, so the people in law should know this, is what is the due date for this essay? Is it the 26th of April? Is that correct? Because that's the due date for similar essays in sociology. I just want to make sure that it's the same, okay? Because in sociology, we cannot actually find this out, are we? So the 26th of April, so it's after you return from the Easter break, okay? Meanwhile, what I would also like you to do, this is common practice in sociology, I don't know if it's so common in law, but I'd like you to do something like a formative essay. That is to say, something that might be a draft of the question you might be working on, and that should be turned into your seminar leader, whoever that person is, on the seventh week. Okay, so the week after the reading week, which is the week of the 22nd of February, you turn that in, yeah.
It's due on the 28th.
28th of April, okay, so all right. Okay, 28th of April for this particular essay. Because in sociology, the other ones are due on the 26th. But the point is, for this formative essay, you turn that in on the seventh week to your seminar leader. It shouldn't be more than 1,000 words, so we're not asking you to do a full draft of the entire essay, but basically providing some sense of what your argument is going to be and some, you know, illustrative readings. You don't have to do a complete bibliography, but some sense of where you're going to go with this essay. And then your seminar leader will offer you some comments before the end of the term, so you'll have something to take away when you go to write the thing for real. Okay? The other thing you should know, I think this both Ralph and I will be doing this for our respective parts of the module, is that there will be an exam review session sometime early in the third term. And the week that we do that, which I believe will probably correspond to one of the lecture weeks, right? So in lecture times, I should say, that week too, there will be the seminars that correspond to that week will also take place. Those will be the only assigned classes for the third term. It'll be when we have the review session lecture and the review session seminar, okay? I have to say, not to discourage you or anything, but last year we actually had very few people turning up to the seminars for that. Some did turn up to the lectures. In any case, they're there for you, and it'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions about what kinds of things might be on the exam. And I will actually run through a kind of list of topics that are likely to show up in the exam. But of course, there are the previous year's exams that you can get access to, which I think have a reasonably good, you know, sort of sense of what the contents are. Okay? Now, from the purely practical side of this module, is there any questions that people have at this point? I will say, the other thing, I communicate by email with you guys, as I did yesterday, and so if anyone didn't get an email from me, then you should come and see me, because you might not be on the list, okay? But that will be the means by which I tell you I have posted stuff, you should go look at the website to get new information, et cetera, et cetera, okay? So that's that mailing list is quite an important part of the way in which we operate here. Okay, are there practical issues that people want to raise at this point? None? So we can actually get down to some content? Okay. Right, so social theory of law, what are we talking about? Okay, there may be some overlap with last term's module, but I think you'll see that even when we're talking about somewhat similar things, we're talking about them in quite different ways. The first point I want to raise, which I was alluding to before, is the fact that law is one of the sources of sociology. Okay. So, for example, Karl Marx, who's often seen as one of the founders of the field. He was trained in law, of course, and a person who began his career as a law professor, Max Weber. Max Weber was, of course, a lawyer and an economist as well. And if you look at the early work of the person who's normally seen as the founder of sociology as a discipline, Emil Durkheim, and these guys that I've just been talking about are the so-called Holy Trinity of classical sociology. For those of you who aren't familiar with the way we teach sociology, we usually teach these three late 19th century, early 20th century guys as kind of the founding figures. Durkheim's earliest work, which was on the division of labor in society, is based on his dissertation, is in fact about the change in the legal arrangements between people that start to take place in the early modern era. Okay? And if you know something about the kind of work that Durkheim went on to do subsequently, right, he was very much concerned with things like the nature of deviance and crime and punishment and responsibility and all of these kinds of legal topics. In terms of how they are conceptualized in society, what do they tell us about the nature of the society that people are in? Okay, so sociology basically comes out of the law, and you might say the thing that fascinates all of these early guys when they're thinking about the sociological character of the law is the fact that the law is formalized, codified. Okay, and this is seen to be kind of a hallmark of modern law. Right? Because if you look at the earliest societies, right, the earliest societies are, first of all, societies that are, generally speaking, not literate, right? But clearly they do have norms and rules by which people interact and, deal with each other, They are not written down, though, right? They are established through habit, through convention, through familiarity, relations of trust. There are all these kinds of notions that we often talk about when we talk about, so-called in the sense that these guys would have used the word, primitive societies. Okay, pre-modern societies is kind of how we would call them now, the kind of thing that anthropologists normally study. And yet there is this transition that takes place. It doesn't happen all at once, of course, but certainly by the time you get into the modern era, there is this greater and greater drive to what we might say is to rationalize the law, which is to say, to write it down, to codify it, to organize it, to make it consistent like it's a kind of system. Right? And this is very much the modern kind of view of the law, and that there's a sense in which, you know, insofar as the laws don't really cohere with each other, there's a problem. In other words, we can't sort of take it as given that laws in different areas of life might be different. We have to somehow think they got to be put together, they got to be organized, and you know, and logic comes into play very often as providing a kind of template for understanding how the law is. Right, so if you think about what a constitution is, right? I mean, a constitution starts with the fundamental principles. The fundamental principles basically, first of all, identify the agents from a legal standpoint. Who are we talking about? We're talking about free individuals, let's say. If you look at the American Constitution, right? Free individuals who are already, you know, endowed with certain rights. So we assume they have certain things. This is part of the basic stuff. And then we build the laws on top of that. We talk about general rights, specific rights, and they all relate to each other. And then, of course, when, you know, people get into trouble, cases arise and adjudications take place, and then the law might be changed as a result, right? And this way of thinking about how the law develops is a very modern notion, okay? Moreover, I think it's also fair to say that we have this kind of conception that at least in principle, every aspect of life should in some sense be legal. Okay? Not necessarily because the law tells you you must do it, right? Because the law can come in many different forms. Okay? And here, you know, when we, in logic, I don't know if you've ever, I mean, again, this may be too much, but deontic modality. Have you ever run across deontic modality is basically the kinds of terms that we use to talk about obligation, permission, prohibition, right? You think about it. All the modes in which the law can operate. Sometimes the law forces you to do things. You are obliged. Sometimes the law allows you to do things. You are permitted, right? Sometimes the law prevents you from doing things. You are prohibited. You see what I mean? These are deontic modalities, right? And part of the kind of modern conception of the law is that in some sense, everything we do should fall into one of these categories, right? It is either obliged, or it's permitted, or it's prevented, or prohibited, okay? And we're going to talk about, that's going to be an important theme in the course, because when we talk, especially when we talk about issues of freedom, right? Because remember, freedom isn't just for you, it's for everyone. And if freedom's for everyone, there's a lot of room for interference. Okay? And this is kind of the great quandary of liberalism from a legal standpoint. And we're going to talk about that, because one of the things that we're going to move into toward the end of this course is the way in which our sense of the kinds of entities that are eligible to be covered by the law are now going beyond ordinary Homo sapiens. Because, you know, it's pretty hard already when we get into the modern period trying to set up laws for human beings to interact with each other in a free, fair, and equitable manner. It is very hard. Why? People are different. People have different demands on society. People do different things. There's a lot of potential for people to get into each other's ways. People might not like other people. People might have problems with other people. Right? We could talk about it, you know, ethnically, class-wise, gender-wise, all these different things, right? Sources of endless conflict which the law has to somehow mediate. But now throw animals into the mix. Now throw machines into the mix. Right? Android rights, animal rights, rights of nature. These are on the horizon. And they're going to create special problems that we haven't seen before. Okay? It's not that we haven't, in a way we have seen some of these problems before, but in a sense, this really does sort of change the picture as to what it is that the law can reasonably be expected to do. Okay? And so when we get, as we get farther into the course, we're going to talk more and more about this issue of rights. Because rights is a very complex notion, it's a very key notion in any kind of liberal understanding of the law, but it is the notion that is under the most pressure at the moment, I would say. What does a right mean when you have so many different sorts of entities claiming them? Okay, so all of this is part of the deontic modality business of what the law does, but in the modern period, there was always this idea that the law's job, one of its jobs is to comprehend all this stuff. Okay? I think there's a kind of you might say there's a sort of folk sociology of what the law's place is in society, right? In for those of you who haven't run across this expression before, folk sociology is just basically the sociology that ordinary people have, right? Everybody's a sociologist, right? We hear this all the time. Well, what kind of sociology does the ordinary person who hasn't been trained in sociology have, right? This is the question, and that's the folk sociology, okay? And folk sociology, you might say, actually draws basically thinks about the law as not being so universal. Right? If you talk to people, how does society hang together? How does society run? Right? They will say, we've got these informal relations. We make some individual contracts, perhaps. We trust each other. A lot of it is very informal. It's not really covered by the law. Right? We don't need judges around all the time. We only need it when people get into trouble. Right? So there's this kind of folk sociology that says law is basically about dispute resolution, essentially. Right? That in some sense, if nobody's around, if nobody's causing any trouble from the standpoint of the people involved, then you don't need the law. You only need the law when someone's complaining and it can't be resolved between the two parties. Then you need the law. This is the folk sociology of the law, right? Where the law has a very restricted kind of role. It only enters into cases of dispute resolution. I think you're familiar with this notion of the law. Right, it gives people an incredible sense of empowerment about getting away with things. Right, if there's no cop watching, hey, what the hell? Okay, and this is why people, for example, don't like things like closed circuit television, because closed circuit television is actually a technological reminder that the law is present at all times, even when you don't see it. Okay, and it's the law that actually gives you the amount, the freedoms that you have. And the extent to which you have those freedoms, that is given to you by the law. Because it's the law who you're going to have to turn to when someone tries to take it away from you. Unless you want to just get into a fist fight with everybody throughout your entire life. Okay? But the point is, there is this folk sociology that says the law is a kind of limited thing. But it's in the modern period that you get this more universal notion of the law. And this is why the law becomes an academic discipline, it becomes a science, you have people doing jurisprudence, and all of these different fields, these more theoretical fields of the law, are basically about trying to get the different parts of the law to hang together. Now, this raises a kind of interesting question. So, I've already mentioned the problem of the consistency of the laws. Because laws do tend to be made in a relatively piecemeal way, right? A problem arises, you suddenly realize you're going to have some need for regulation because this case might come up again. But then you're just going to regulate that particular domain, but that may have knock-on effects on what happens with other aspects of the law, but you're not going to discover that until another problem arises. So the cases they mount up, and the law is kind of shifted around in light of those things. That's right, there's all those problems there. But then there's a kind of, you might say, more fundamental problem. We're going to talk about this in the course too. And this has to do with the normative standing of the law. Okay? Now, normative is, we're going to have a whole week on this. Normative is a kind of big word, very philosophical word. And you might say that there is a kind of limited and a wide understanding of this term. The limited understanding of this term is basically the normative just means what the norms happen to be. In other words, to talk about norms is to talk about a kind of fact. Right? So if you want to know what is the normative structure of society, one answer you might give is the laws. Right? You know, and if you ask someone, I live in this society, how should I behave with regard to my spouse? How should I behave with regard to my children? They say, well, look, the law tells you. That's what you want to do. You're allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. Right? And there's all these things, and there it is. It's a fact about the way this society works, that this is how you treat people. That's a limited notion of norm, because it basically treats the norm as a fact. So whatever the laws are, that's what the norms are. Okay? You know, and you know, the sacred version of this is to say, well, why is it, you know, why should you do this? Well, the Bible says so. It's basically at that level, right? Where you have a kind of fundamental fact that you go back to. Okay? And so that's a familiar notion. It's a kind of, it's limited. Why is it limited? Well, because it doesn't really, when people ask the question, what should you do? What ought you to do? They usually are thinking about this question a little bit differently. They're usually looking at it from what in philosophy is called a second order standpoint. In other words, they're actually looking for what the best law is, what the best way of operating is. They're not just looking for what the rules happen to be, what the norms happen to be, what the facts say that you should do, but rather what they're looking for is some kind of some understanding of how it is we ought to behave. And this second order notion of norm, which is the kind of thing that you often see written into the foundations of constitutional documents, right, are basically about principles, about ideals that we stand for as a people, right? The sorts of things that we hope our laws will manifest, but maybe do not. Right? We say we live in a free and just society where everyone is created equal. But is that how our laws are organized? Do our laws actually allow this principle to be realized? The principle is fine, but the laws may be at fault. That's the second order view. That's the wider view of norm. Because there's a sense in which second order, you're actually appealing to what gets called, in the American context, this phrase gets used a lot, the higher law. Right? There's the law on the books, but then there's this higher law. Right? And it's like God's law, but understood in a secular way. I don't know how many of you have read Ronald Dworkin. How many of you have read, you know Ronald Dworkin, the legal theorist? Some of you may have read him. This is a guy full of higher law. Right, that's where he's coming from. The way he makes judgments about cases, the way he talks about how a judge ought to operate when adjudicating cases, right? In a sense, what he's always concerned about is, you might say, another way of looking at this is the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law may not always be recognized in the letter of the law. And so the judge has to do some kind of major move to change things. And of course, legislators change laws in the back of this too. If we've got a legal system that doesn't fully realize the principles on which the society stands, then we've got to change the laws. Okay? Now, historically, this idea, the way it kind of gets into the sort of modern Western legal consciousness, is through the thing that we're going to be talking about next week. And that's this thing called natural law. Okay? Have you guys studied natural law? Okay? You have some sense? Okay. Natural law is in terms of the history of this kind of codification of the law that I've been talking about that's been so much part of the modern era, natural law is basically the first moment of that. Okay? It is the first, it is where you might say the consciousness arises that we actually need a system of laws that is coherent, that covers all cases, right, under fundamental principles. And these are principles in the first instance when natural law got started, in the, you know, largely in the Middle Ages, right, it was religious law, right? Islam, Christianity, Judaism, these were the principles of natural law were derived from there, and the definition of the human being as understood by those religions, and then the sorts of things that followed from that. And this is where you get the first modern, the first explication of legal scholarship, jurisprudence, the kind of thing that we're still talking about today begins there. Okay? And it is also where you get this idea of there being a higher law, the God's law, as it were. Okay? Now, this notion of the higher law, as I say, you know, it's still around with guys like Ronald Dworkin, it's, you know, if you look at the history of the revolutions in the 18th and 19th and 20th centuries, you're constantly getting this kind of language of, you know, human beings are born with inalienable rights by the Creator. This is in the U.S. Declaration of Independence. Where is this coming from? This is from natural law, right? Because this is an argument that Thomas Jefferson and all of these guys in the colonial period were making to say the laws established in Britain are just human laws. And those laws are subject to a higher authority, the law of God. And the law of God says people have the right to be free. And if they are not allowed the right to be free, then they have the right to revolt. This is all in natural law theory, actually. This is nothing that was invented by the moderns. This is already in natural law theory. I'll say more about that next week. But the point is that natural law is really the first sort of stopping post where we get to this idea of a formal, codified legal system that is meant to cover everything in the society. Now, this then raises another question, and I'll end the lecture on this point, and that is, to what extent should we expect the law, in this larger, wider normative sense, the second order sense, to actually change normal social behavior? Okay? Because this is going to be another point that is going to be very much part of the modern period as well, which is the idea, and again, if you've read Ronald Dworkin, you'll know what I'm talking about. Because one of the things that Dworkin, one of the things that motivates Dworkin, for example, to think about using some higher notion of law to change existing law is the fact that he associates the principles that he's trying to realize with certain policies. Right? And that for him, the law is kind of an instrument for realizing these policies, and these policies will then give us laws that are more in alignment with our fundamental principles. Okay? And again, this is kind of the way Dworkin generally reasons about these things. I mention him because even though natural law theory does, even to this day, still have this kind of religious connotation to it, and probably the people who practice natural law the most are probably religious legal scholars. Nevertheless, if you look at somebody like Dworkin, he's making exactly these moves within a secular context. Okay? And what the suggestion here is that the law can be used as an instrument to make people better. Right? In other words, ordinary social relations may in fact be conducted quite peacefully, but they may nevertheless be unjust, right? I mean, if you think about it, what is the measure of injustice in a society? Okay, do you have to wait till somebody actually commits violence and starts a revolution before realizing the society's unjust? No, of course not. You can have certain kinds of ideals, certain kinds of principles that you think your society stands for, and if you look at the way in which the laws are currently playing out, you might realize that these ideals are not being realized. and that you need to change the laws. Okay? This is a very powerful idea, and in fact, what gets called sociological jurisprudence, which is a kind of an American thing, which early 20th century evolves into this movement you may have heard of called legal realism. And we'll be talking about these things too. And this is very much on this point, namely that one of the functions of the law is not only to be it's not only to make society more coherent and better organized and better structured from a logical standpoint, but it's actually trying to realize certain principles that will enable the empowerment of all the people. Right? So in other words, law is meant to be a kind of progressive force, socially progressive force. And that's what sociological jurisprudence, legal realism, that's what they were about in the early 20th century. And the United States, you may know about the progressive movement of the United States in the early 20th century, the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt, right? You may know about what happened after the war with Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, resolving the civil rights issues. All of this involved legal realists. They were involved in all these things, okay? In government sometimes, as kind of sympathetic judges in crucial court cases, right? They were there, okay? But, you know, as we shall see, this kind of idea can only take you so far, okay? That there are lots of criticisms that are made of the idea, whether it's an appropriate understanding of the law, but also I think the real, you know, so we're going to look at the critical legal studies movement, which some of you may have run across as well, as a kind of critique of legal realism, but from a relatively sympathetic standpoint. In other words, these people also think they're on the left, okay? But then I think what you end up getting at the end is this crucial challenge about just how heterogeneous, how diverse a society can be covered under the same body of law. And of course, we already face this problem with regard to issues of multiculturalism, for example, but we are going to face this problem in a much bigger way in the future with regard to the animal rights issues and eventually the android rights issues. Because if you think multiculturalism is a problem now, you wait till you see these other creatures coming into play. It really causes enormous amounts of challenges, okay? But that's giving you a sense of the progression of the course, how we're going to proceed. So we're going to end by talking about that and whether it still makes sense to talk about some notion of human rights as underwriting the law. Okay, that'll you might say be the final question. It'll be part of one of the assessed essay questions on offer about whether the notion of human rights has a future. Okay? Okay. Well, so are there any questions about this? What I've said? I just want to let you know I will be putting up all this stuff hopefully today, and I will be sending you an email message so you'll be able to keep up with what's happening here. But if there are any questions now? No questions? You sure? Okay. So you just wait for me to send you an email message and we'll just proceed from there. And then I will see you next week. Okay?